From the headquarters of the American Radio Relay League in Newington, Connecticut, this is ARRL, The Doctor Is In, a bi-weekly podcast addressing common and some not-so-common technical issues in amateur radio. This podcast is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. And now, here's your host, QST Editor-in-Chief Steve Ford, WB8IMY, and the doctor himself, QST Contributing Editor Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Hello, I'm Steve Ford, WB8IMY.
And I'm Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Joel, we have the ideal topic, field day. And field day and generators go hand in hand, so let's talk generators.
All right. That certainly is the case.
You have a big generator at your house.
Well, medium size, 2,500 watts. It's actually a portable gasoline-powered electric start generator. I used to have a UPS system for my ham gear, which would keep it going instantly without any break at all if I lost power, which was quite useful. It had I actually wrote an article about it. Actually, the first QST article I ever wrote back in 2003 or something. But anyway, that worked fine, but I realized that it's great to have your radio working. But after a while, if your refrigerator doesn't work and your freezer doesn't work, and in the wintertime, if your heating system doesn't work and your pipes freeze, having a radio operating is little comfort for that.
Well, it's for you, I mean, a radio is all I need personally.
But. Yeah, well, you could have a big coat, but then you need buckets for the broken pipes and all that. So, and I've taken so many giant bags of rotten food to the dump after a week's outage that I got tired of it. So I went with a generator, and now I don't even bother with the UPS anymore because it doesn't take me very long to fire up the generator. It's always connected to the system through a transfer switch. The transfer switch is very important, and I can't stress that enough. If you're using the generator to power household circuits, there's another option. You can, and I actually have been known to do this before I put this system in. I borrowed a generator from my son-in-law, who has all kinds of things that are handy. He had made up some heavy-duty cables that he's in the audio business and does performances in the field, so he has this all set up. Long, heavy cables, multiple outlets, and everything properly designed and fused and built for this. And we could run that through the house and plug in the refrigerator and so forth. And at that particular outage, I didn't have to worry about the heat, so I didn't have to manage to get the furnace tied into it. But that's certainly an option, is to do that. But if you're not going to think you need it very often. We've had so many power outages in our area over the last few years that it makes sense to have a transfer switch, which just transfers the circuits that are important to you, in one case towards the utility power, in the other case towards the generator. And it's extremely important that you do this if you want to power your circuits from the generator. If you try to avoid that, some people backfeed into a backwards wired socket kind of arrangement and put power into their household from the generator that way, thinking that'll work. It really doesn't work very well because the big problem is a safety problem for the people trying to restore the power. The lineman's out on the pole thinking the power is down, and your power is backfeeding into the pole if you don't make sure it isn't. And he could have 8,000 volts on the high wires there from you without expecting them because he's pulled the power breakers getting into that neighborhood, and he thinks he's dealing with a dead circuit. So it's very dangerous situation. In addition, it has some practical limitations. Assistant lab manager Bob Allison was describing a situation at his household where there was a power outage, and all of a sudden his power started to come back, but it came back in a very kind of fluctuating way, and it was sort of like a brownout and up and down and back and forth, and it stayed on for a little while and then disappeared again. He found out afterwards what had happened was one of his neighbors had done that and ended up inadvertently powering the whole neighborhood, which put a little bit of a strain on his generator, which eventually burned up. So that's another reason not to do this. Now, an obvious answer is to trip the main breakers going to the street, which avoids that. But that's not a really good solution because someone may forget to do that. It's also possible to have a failure of a breaker. I've had breakers fail partly open and partly shorted. I actually had a fire in them once. burned down my entrance panel. Anyway, so use a transfer switch. And then before you purchase a generator, you need to decide how much power you need to supply. A way to do that is decide which circuits in your house are critical, so you know how many circuits you need to have on your transfer switch, and then what the power requirements is on each of them. Now, what I used was a device that we reviewed. Actually, you reviewed it in a short take in 2006, the P3 International Kilowatt.
Oh, yes, the kilowatt.
Which
yes.
you can plug into a socket and plug a device into, and it'll tell you how much power it's consuming. So you write that down for all the items that you want to have on a circuit that you're going to switch to the generator and add these all up. That'll give you an idea of how much power you need to supply. But be aware that that will tell you the average power. If you have devices such as refrigerators or air conditioners or freezers that have motors in them, the starting current of the motor can be easily three or four times the running current. And the generator has to supply the starting current as well as the running current. So you need to take that into account. Sometimes you can find out from the manufacturer of the device what the starting current is, or you can kind of estimate it, and you hope that not everything starts at the same time. Although, if you have things off for a while and suddenly bring them on, chances are they will all start at the same time. So a safer way to do it is to have them on separate circuits and bring up one circuit at a time so that you don't have all these motors starting at once, or you might find the generator starts to run backwards or something tears itself apart. So that gets you can get to the amount of power you want. Now, keep in mind that generators are usually rated at kilowatts or watts, but really what their rating allows them to do is volt amps. And you say, well, if I multiply volts times amps, I get watts. Well, that's true, but it's only true for resistors. If you have an inductive load that isn't actually drawing much power, it can draw a lot of current at times, depending on what's going on. So the point is that the current and voltage are not in the same phase. You don't actually get the same power. So you're not using the power, but you're drawing a lot of current. So you have to take that into account a little bit, depending on what kind of loads you have. I don't think that's a big deal. So for most households, the numbers you get from the kilowatt will probably be okay. But this is a subject called power factor, which is a little more than we want to get into here. But it is something to bear in mind.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what. Let's take a break. I have some questions specifically about field day. But let's hear from DX Engineering, and we'll be right back.
All right.
Remember your first contact? The excitement of that first CQ? The exhilaration of making your first QSO? At DX Engineering, we know that feeling too. That's why we've committed to making your on-air experience the very best it can be. DX Engineering ships quickly, which means less station downtime. And we have free shipping for almost any order over $99. We've recently expanded our inventory, so you don't have to wait for the gear you need. DX Engineering has introduced all new radio products and revived legendary brands, all with the goal of helping you enjoy amateur radio. Most importantly, the DX Engineering team is here to help you. You've got a team of highly experienced hands ready to work out technical issues, answer questions, and help you optimize your station performance. That excitement you felt from the first contact, it can happen again and again with help from DX Engineering. DXEngineering.com. That's DXEngineering.com.
And we're back. As promised, I have a question about field day, Joel.
Okay.
Now, for field day, we're usually talking about the small, even in some cases, portable generators.
Yep.
Hypothetically, how do I figure out how much power I really need for, say, a field day site with one HF transceiver and so on? How do you go about determining that?
Well, the same way, really. I mean, you just have to make sure you take into account all the things you have, because you won't just have the radio. You'll probably have a clock, and you'll have a PC, and you'll have perhaps a light if you're staying on all night, and maybe a heater, depending on where you live, and coffee pot, and so forth. So do go through the same exercise and add them all up, and that should give you an idea of the total power that you need. You can do it by measuring it, or you can look at the manufacturer's specifications. So if your transceiver has a 20-amp DC supply, you look up that supply's literature, and it'll tell you how much current or how much power it consumes when it's at full load, or it should. If it doesn't, call a manufacturer and tell them they aren't giving you all the information you need. But, you know, a 100-watt light bulb should consume about 100 watts, for example.
Yes.
Your coffee pot should tell you what it is. And some of those things have dramatic amounts of power, particularly heaters and coffee pots, surprising amount of power requirements. So just add them all up. And, you know, maybe it means that you have to remember not to have the coffee pot and the heater on at the same time or other combinations. So you can play that a little bit.
And I also recall a couple of years ago, we had a product review, QST product review, that discussed RF hash from generators, and that was a big problem.
That is. It's more of a problem with some types of generators than others, and there are really two categories of generators that you need to think about. One of them is sort of the traditional gasoline engine, rotary generator, that's it kind of thing. It's just very straightforward, hooked together by a shaft, and they have to run at some particular RPM to give you 60 hertz power, which you probably want, especially if you have a clock on it.
Yes.
But most equipment likes to be at around 60 hertz. And that has to run at a fixed speed no matter how much power you draw. And as a consequence, that can be fairly noisy. But the good news is most of those generators don't put out much hash. The other kind of generator is a very interesting one, fairly new and more expensive. If you have a motor that drives a generator, but the generator is not putting out AC, it's putting out DC, what that means is it'll run a lot slower and quieter, and they're amazingly quiet. Even the big ones. I borrowed one from my son-in-law, who was a, 5,000-watt generator or something. Fortunately, he'd brought it over in his truck, so I didn't have to carry it. And I guess this raises the question of what you mean by portable. There are a lot of...
Yes.
But nonetheless, this thing was almost... You could carry on a conversation standing right next to it while it was running. Now, I wasn't using 5,000 watts. I might have been using 1,200 watts or thing. But I notice in my generator that I'm rarely using more than 10 or 15% of its capacity just because things aren't always turned on and the motors aren't always running and the refrigerator sits quietly most of the time if you don't leave the door open. They're very quiet acoustically. That's the good news. The bad news is the part of it that acts like a switching power supply works like a switching power supply. It's got transformers operating at fairly high frequencies, and it doesn't make exactly sine waves, and they have harmonics, and you can get hash from them.
Oh.
So, but the answer is that they are filterable in just the same way that a switching power supply is, which is to say you put a line, good quality line filter right at the generator before you get into the wires. You don't want the hash in the wires because they'll radiate into the antennas, but you get it before they get into the wires.
You mean a commercial line filter or what?
There are very good commercial line filters. You may find that the garden variety computer outlet power distribution strips that supposedly have filters in them do not do much for you.
No.
But there are some good ones. We've reviewed some. There was one from a company called ICE in Canada that was reviewed some years ago that did a remarkable job. Now, unfortunately, I don't think they're still in business. I'm not sure if somebody else has picked up on that filter. I know somebody's making some of their RF filters. But there are industrial quality line filters that will make a big difference and should probably work well. And it may be that some of the manufacturers have gotten wise to this and are trying to make it less of a problem. So something to think about. Probably the lowest cost ones will generally have the most noise.
Yes.
It's a general rule. But that doesn't mean an expensive one will necessarily have no noise. And, they didn't design these with hams in mind. Now, there are probably enough hams that have called them and complained that maybe they're getting better at it. I mean, they're just so quiet, you can have it, almost have it. You don't want a generator in the tent with you.
No.
Because you won't hear the noise after a while because you'll be dead
from carbon monoxide.
But it can be right outside the tent and not bother anybody. And that's what's nice. And they also tend to be fairly light. They don't have to have all the windings to supply the power directly. There are a number of manufacturers. We actually reviewed some a few years ago. I don't know the issue right offhand, but in QSD, I think we reviewed three of these. So just looking at them, I'm sure we talked about the RF noise from them, and that's something to look at. So that's
always a factor.
There are other safety issues to worry about. We're taking on the role of the power company here.
Yes.
So we have to think about things like electrical safety, and there's a little bit of a question about grounding techniques, and I'd suggest if you tie a generator into your household, look at what the manufacturer says about grounding. And oftentimes, because the green wire of the power system, the ground wire, is connected to your household ground system, that may be sufficient grounding for that. There's some people may argue about that, but I think I'd check the manufacturer's recommendation for that. On the other hand, if you're in the field without, you're not connected to any commercial power, now you're your own power company. And I would suggest that you make sure all your equipment has three-wire grounded outlets. And I would put a ground connection at the generator ground rod at the generator. It's probably a good idea. I don't know if it's absolutely necessary, but I would think that would make a lot of sense. And use ground fault interrupters if you have any kind of wet areas around, so you don't get some kind of shock. So be careful about electrical safety. Think about it. Make sure you do connect it up sensibly.
Because you look at this little generator at your field day site, and you think, oh, well, that couldn't harm anybody, but it certainly can.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And not only from the electricity, the other thing is the fuel. Gasoline, as we know, is a very volatile fluid, and it's very easy to cause a real inferno. You know, if you've got a couple gallons of gas in there, that can make quite a dramatic event happen. So you have to be very careful when refueling the tank that you don't spill fuel on a hot engine. Some people recommend waiting until it cools off, which is probably a good idea. But at field day, that might not be reasonable. But you want to make sure you do it in a way that you can't spill onto the engine, which is hot. That's sort of rule one. And, you know, use proper containers and keep them closed and covered, so forth. And don't let kids anywhere near any of this stuff.
Or some of your operators.
Or some of your operators. That's true. Yep, that's absolutely true. The other thing about generators, you know, a household application again. A lot of people in my neighborhood, we have natural gas, which is very nice for many ways. And it's, I think, perfect for emergency power because it's there all the time. So a lot of my neighbors have fixed in place natural gas powered generators. They don't have to fill them with gasoline. That's very handy because one of the problems I have is if I have I have enough gasoline on hand in my garage to run about 60 or 70 hours, which takes up a lot of gas containers.
Yes.
Because I burn about half a gallon an hour. The problem is if I have an extended outage that's extending over the whole town for a week, the gas stations aren't open either. And you have a real problem on your hands. Sometimes you can't get out of your garage to get to where gas is. So think about that. Make sure you take that into account and have a source. One potential source, which I haven't successfully made use of, is to be able to siphon out of your gas tanks, which the gas tank, automobile gas tanks are harder to siphon out of than they used to be.
Yes.
But, you know, that's if you're careful and know how to do it, that's potentially a good source. But having a number of cans on hand is important. And the other thing that's important is to, if you use gasoline, run it once a month. Or run it, period. Well, I guess there are two ways to do this. What you don't want to do is have it sit there with gas in the tank and say, oh, the power's going out, let me start this up. And you haven't started it for 2 years. And what's happened is all the gas has gelled up and made a mess in your carburetor. Nothing works. It doesn't start. You can't get a service person there because the roads are all full of snow or whatever, trees, whatever's happening. So the two choices are either anytime you run it dry, and then when you need it, put fuel in and start it up again. And the only problem with that is you have to crank a little longer to get the fuel through the system. But what I do is the other approach is, particularly with an electric start generator that has a battery that needs to be charged, I run mine religiously for 1 hour a month. I put the house loads on it. My wife doesn't like listening to it, so I try to time it for when she's at the hairdresser or something.
Yes.
And I keep track of it, and I keep a log, and when I have to do maintenance on the generator, I do it. And I just make sure the generator is going to be ready when I need it.
At League headquarters here in Newington, we have a very big generator that sits next to W1AW, and they fire that up, I believe, every Wednesday, and just to make sure that it's running properly and everything is working well.
Yeah, you really need to do that. I noticed the my neighbors that have the gas, natural gas fire generators, they do that automatically. They come on about once a month and run, so their batteries get charged. I hear them come on. And they're actually quieter than mine is. So when mine comes on, I more than compensate for the noise that they make when theirs comes on. But I think it's important to do that. Otherwise, you aren't going to have a generator when you need it. And the gasoline is another thing. You have gasoline sitting around. It doesn't get any better with age. So I mark on the can when I fill it. And then within a month, I put in enough stabilizer to keep it working for a year. And at the end of the year, I dump it into a car, and it'll run just fine, and replace it. So I, again, religiously keep track of all this stuff and make sure that when I need it, it's going to work.
Well, if you're all set for a question, Joel, I have one for you.
Oh, good.
This one's from Melvin, K3MFP. And he's asking, how can I eliminate unwanted signals from a 2-meter frequency that is more than 50 to 75 miles away with my RF gain turned all the way down?
Well, I'm guessing that what you're talking about is a situation that I also had, which is handy because then I know the answer. But I think what's probably happening here is that you're monitoring a local repeater, listening to their output frequency at your home station. And I say home station because on your car, you probably wouldn't hear this guy at 50 to 75 miles away. But what happens is if you're like my home station where I have the kitchen 2-meter radio tied to an antenna on the chimney, I'm fairly up, fairly high, like most hams are if they choose their property carefully. In Connecticut, I can hear repeaters from New Jersey, you know, 50, 60, 70 miles away without any problem, full quieting, line of sight path, because of course the repeater antennas are also high. So generally, at least the ones you hear are high. The ones that are low, you don't hear, not a problem. So what happens is they're far enough apart, so the frequency coordination people figure they won't interfere with local operations of your local repeater, which is probably true. Most of the time, if you're in your car, you won't have any problems with them. But from home, you have a much different situation with a line of sight path, and it comes in just as strong as, almost as strong as your local repeater. There are three solutions to this problem that come to my mind. And the easiest and cheapest is to see if your repeater transmits CTCSS tones, what we used to often call private line tones, with the transmit signal. Now, you know, usually you use those to access the repeater. So not every repeater also transmits them, but some do. Some just pass them through. Some generate them again at the repeater. If they don't, ask your control operator if they can set it up to do that. And then if your radio at home has an option that you can use CTCSS selective call on the receive signal, you can set that up so the squelch won't open unless your repeater is transmitting. So unless you happen to have the situation in which your repeater and that distant repeater happen to use the same transmit tone, which is fairly unlikely, that's a perfect solution. That's what I did. That was very easy to incorporate. So that gets rid of it. So it's still there, but you can't hear it. So your receiver only opens when your local repeater comes on. Now, another thing you can do, if you don't have that option, is not all radios support receive CTCSS squelch. Most new ones do, but depending on what kind of radio you have, that may not do it. So the easiest solution, if you don't have that one available, is to have an indoor antenna, change to an indoor antenna. Now, what you can do is you could have a switch, and you could switch to your outdoor antenna when you want to talk to that repeater in New Jersey, or when you want to work other repeaters further away. But chances are your local repeater, if it's like my situation, will work fine with your home station and an indoor antenna down at kitchen level. You try that. The other thing, if that doesn't work, is to go to a directional antenna and put the null for the minimum signal while you're listening to that station you don't want to hear, or just find out where the azimuth is and get a compass and line it up. Point the back of that antenna to the station that you don't want to hear. Now, you may not be pointed exactly at the station you do want to hear, but chances are if it's local, you'll have a strong enough signal that even if it comes in from the side of the beam, it will be strong enough to get through. If they both happen to be in the same line, you may have a problem, but chances are they won't be in exactly the same line. And even if they are, it might be that off the back of the beam, your local repeater will be strong enough so you can hear it. Now, of course, that means that restricts the stations you'll be able to communicate with. So again, you may want to have a switch to switch between the two. Or if that's the only station you want to work regularly, or if they're all in the same general area, same direction, maybe this will work for you. So those are three solutions. And if another possibility, of course, with the Yagi is to put a rotator on it and turn it so you can, A, turn it so you get minimum signal from the distant station, and B, turn it so you can talk to the people you want to when you want to talk to them. But I think one or more of those will solve your problem.
Thank you, Joel.
My pleasure.
ARRL, The Doctor Is In, is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. For more information on amateur radio or the ARRL, visit us on the web at www.arrl.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for ARRL. If you have a question or comment for the doctor, send an email to doctor@arrl.org. Background music is courtesy of Ben Sound at www.bensound.com. This program is provided under the copyright of the ARRL. Until next time, I'm QST Managing Editor Becky Schoenfeld, W1BXY 73, and thanks for listening.